You can actually go ahead and be turning there if you're not already there. We'll be in the book of John again tonight in chapter 1. It has been a couple of weeks since we've been in this book. We've had several things that we've had come up to keep us from getting back in here, but I'm looking forward to being back in and preaching through this again, and it's been a good study for me. It's been a quick study. It's always quick having to go from preaching on a Sunday to preaching on a Wednesday. I've only done it once or twice. Todd's done it quite a few times, so he doesn't have any sympathy for me, but it is a quick turnaround. I have enjoyed the study, though. Tonight, we are going to be covering verses 14 through 18. We will get to the end of John's opening prologue tonight. And to kind of catch us, I guess, back up a little bit, these first 18 verses of the book of John are what are considered the prologue of John. It is in these opening 18 verses that John really is trying to hammer home, he's trying to explain the eternality and godhood of Jesus. I hope that we've seen that as we've gone through this, and I hope that as we go through these last few verses tonight that we're reminded of how John has done that thus far. But that's been his primary purpose. He wants to explain Jesus better. He wants us to know Jesus better, but specifically he wants us to know, again, that Jesus is God. He is the eternal God. And these 18 verses explain that, but then they open up, really, the rest of the book. Because that's John's purpose throughout the rest of the book, is to explain how Jesus, the man Jesus, was God and is God. So, the passage tonight will bring us all the way back to verse 1, but it will also, again, spring us forward to the rest of the book. We will see tonight how God uniquely revealed Himself to humanity through Jesus Christ. The title of my sermon tonight, I'm stealing from the passage itself, it is "The Word Became Flesh." It's been a while since we've actually read through this. Let's just read through the entire prologue. In verse 1, we read, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." And then in verse 14, we begin our passage tonight. "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about Him and cried out, 'This was He of whom I said, He who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known.'" So if we look back to verse 1, John began in verse 1 by telling us that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I thought Todd did a great job of explaining to us a few weeks ago what that passage was saying and what the Word is, what that meant, the depth of that. I don't have enough time really to go into the depth of the Word, what John was trying to explain and what he was trying to get across by using that word, or logos. There in verse 1, if you want to go back and listen to Todd's sermon, he gives a great description and a great explanation, a definition of that. But here, we know that the Word is Jesus, and that Jesus, as the Word, is eternal. He is the Creator. The Word is how God expressed Himself throughout the Old Testament. We're going to dig into this a little bit more as we get to the end of this section, but God, He did not express Himself really in invisible form, not in a way that was really understandable or personable. But now as we get into verse 14, we read that the Word became flesh. Let's stop there for a second. The Word became flesh. I know we know this verse. I know this is a common verse. We've read over it a hundred times or more, and we've talked about it, we've quoted it. But let's take a minute to really try to let the magnitude of that truth sink in. Do you realize how feeble and weak the human body is? Don't get me wrong, God has He's created our bodies to do magnificent things and to do great things, perform amazing feats, but at the end of the day, our human bodies are still feeble and weak. They're corrupting, they're decaying. We all get older. I'm finding that out more and more every day. Our bodies are weak, especially in comparison to God, right? There is no weakness or feebleness in God. There's only power, there's only strength. He's the Creator. Not only did He create us, but He formed the sun. Think of the power of the sun. The power in the sun, though, it's tiny really compared to the rest of the stars in the universe that the Word created. Look, we can't fathom the power of God. He spoke us into existence, and if He wanted to, He could just speak us out of existence. And not even by natural causes, not even by a natural death. I mean, He could just speak and we would cease to exist. We would disappear. But I think one of the most amazing displays of God's power was in the fact that He concealed all of that power, all of that glory, at least glory in the sense of the glory we're not able to look upon as fallen humans. He concealed that to take on the body of a man, to take on human flesh. I mean, common sense would say that putting that power into a frail human body would just destroy the body. It would disintegrate the flesh. It couldn't hold that power. But God was able to set aside that or conceal it and take on flesh. That in and of itself should speak to the power of God, right? And it really is amazing when we think about the Word becoming flesh. Now, at this time, there was likely a major push in churches or among Christians for what is called docetism. Docetism was a teaching basically that denied that Jesus Christ had come in the flesh, that He become flesh, and they tried to separate really the earthly Jesus from the heavenly Christ. They tried to, it's almost like dualism, what's known as dualism today. There was also, at this time, the common pagan belief about their own deity. It was common for Greek and Roman gods to possess a human body or appear as a human body and then interact with humans. Most of the time, that interaction was a god or a goddess falling in love with a human, and that eventually resulted in a human child who being born, who then became a demigod. Think of Achilles or Hercules. Both were examples of demigods. One, a human that had a god father or a god mother, and then a human, human mother, a human father. But those Greek and Roman gods, they weren't really humans in those cases, right? They didn't come as, came in the form of a human, but it was temporary. It went away. They weren't really humans. They just indwelled them or created a version of a human body that was not really theirs. At no point did any of those gods actually become human, 100% human. John, though, here is very intentional with his language. It wasn't enough or it wasn't accurate enough for John to just say that the Word assumed manhood or that the Word adopted a form of a body. Commentators suggest that the language that John used here to explain the Word becoming flesh, it really would have been shocking to the reader by how explicit he's being, what he's actually saying here. John is being very, very clear, or as clear as possible, that the Word did not just come and indwell a body or have a makeshift temporary body. No, He became flesh. He became 100% human. He was as much human physically as you and I are. He became everything human that we are, with the exception of one thing. He did not inherit our human sinful nature that we got from Adam. He did not inherit that because He did not have an earthly father, right? When the Word became flesh, God became man, as F.F. Bruce states. He goes on to state that the Word built a bridge between transcendent deity and the insignificance of man. I thought that was a really good way of putting it and describing what John is saying here when the Word became flesh. But as we read on, not only did the Word become flesh, but we see that He dwelt among us. He dwelt among man. Now, as Christians, we believe Jesus lived a normal human life, right? He lived with family, with friends, and then He lived until He died on the cross. He experienced normal human experiences, normal human emotions. John is trying to draw the reader's attention to something even more than that, though, here. He's drawing important parallels to God in the Old Testament. It says the Word dwelt among us. And the word for dwelt here could be translated, He pitched His tent or pitched a tabernacle. And immediately as we think of that, our minds should be drawn back to Exodus 25, verse 8. In that passage we read, "Then have them make a sanctuary." This is God speaking to Moses. "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them." We should think of the tabernacle where God dwelt in the wilderness with Israel. The Shekinah glory, which literally means, Shekinah literally means residence. God's residence, so to speak, was that cloud which led the Israelites in the wilderness. That is the Hebrew equivalent of this word here, dwelt. John is telling us that that same glory, that same God, whom mankind could only see as expressed as that cloud, because they couldn't take the full impact of His glory, He actually dwelt with us as human in the person of Jesus. God manifested His presence to the children of Israel in the tabernacle and later in the temple, but now, in a much fuller sense, He has made Himself known by dwelling with us and becoming flesh. John continues along this thought by saying that we have seen His glory. Glory that as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Another way of putting that is, we saw His glory, the glory of the one and only, full of grace and truth, who came from the Father. The glory displayed in the Son, or in the one and only, or the Word, is the kind of glory that a Father, the Father, grants to His own one and only, best loved, or unique Son. Only Jesus could be granted this glory, could have this glory as the Son of God. The verb here for have seen, or in some versions we read beheld, has the same root of the word where we get theater from. Think of a theater. It's the same root word that we get beheld or has seen here. As Merrill Tinney states, this word involves a careful scrutiny of what is before one in order to understand its significance. He goes on and says, all the information that human investigation could produce was made available by His willingness, Jesus' willingness, to be questioned and observed. Meaning, Jesus, as the God-man, He allowed humanity to observe Him or question Him in any and every way that they wanted while He was here on earth. And at least for the apostles, as we read here, as John states, their conclusion was, we saw the glory of God, which was full of grace and truth. John is confessing and professing, really, throughout the whole book, but here specifically, that he knows Jesus to be God because Jesus proved Himself to be God in every way as we inspected Him and as we saw His glory, full of grace and truth. Full of grace and truth here, it looks like it's referring to Jesus in the English, doesn't it? In the Greek, though, this is a little bit harder. It's not as clear. It's not exactly clear that it's referring to Jesus. I won't try to give us a Greek lesson, so I'll just say that it could be referring to Jesus, full of grace and truth. But more likely, it is referring to the word glory. So essentially, John is saying the glory of the word that dwelt among them was full of grace and truth. And this makes even more sense when you consider the Old Testament parallel here. Again, in Exodus, and we had a little bit of this lesson this weekend, a little bit by Brian and also by Brother Hunter. But in Exodus 33, chapters 33 and 34, we read the account where Moses asked God to show him his glory. God's response to Moses when he asked that was, "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, Yahweh, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But you cannot see my face, for one may not see me and live." Did you notice the attributes of God or attributed to God's glory there? Mercy, compassion, and goodness, mainly goodness there. Then later on in Exodus chapter 34, verse 5, we read, "Then Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him," Moses, "there and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed, 'Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity on the fathers, on the children, and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation.'" The words there in Exodus, the words here for full of grace and truth here in verse 14, they were often used to render that last phrase there in Exodus in verse 6, steadfast love and faithfulness. They're kind of interchangeable. So the glory that Moses witnessed in the cleft of the rock there was the glory revealed in Jesus. Moses heard the word and the hinder parts of that glory, but Jesus actually manifested it visibly to humans. The ultimate revelation of this glory came at the cross, where he ultimately showed his glory and his goodness and his mercy there at the cross. Then in verse 15, we get this little parenthesis. We read, "John bore witness about him and cried out, 'This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me.'" It kind of seems out of place here in the middle of this. John writes again about John the Baptist. He gives us a little preview of actually what he's going to be speaking about or writing about again in verse 19. We see here John the Baptist, he bore witness of the Word who became flesh, meaning he told others about him, right? He bore witness of Jesus. And then it says that John said this, "This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me." This is what John the Baptist said about Jesus. This is his testimony of Jesus. There were some people who followed John the Baptist who thought that he himself was the Messiah, right? They had a mistaken a view of John. John told them he was not the Messiah, right? He was not the light. He was only giving testimony, only bearing witness about the light. And when Jesus began his ministry, there were some of John's followers who were they were jealous for John. They were upset because people were going to Jesus and following Jesus. And so they came to him about that. And John, in response, he told them, he said, "Look, I told you I was only bearing witness to the Messiah who was to come after me. I'm not him." He goes even further in saying that Jesus ranked before him. That's what he says here in this passage, meaning that Jesus was superior to him. Then we see why John the Apostle included this parenthesis here in this passage. And we see it's really not out of place at all. He states that Jesus was before him. John the Baptist states that Jesus was before him. As we've noted several times, the culture at this time was heavily in favor of the firstborn or older, the oldest. And John the Baptist was older than Jesus. Now, they weren't brothers, but there was still a sense in which him being older carried more authority, carried a sense of respect over Jesus. Normally, in normal human view. So why would John say this? We know John was born before Jesus, even though it was a couple of months. Well, he's saying here that Jesus was in fact before him. He existed before he existed. John the Baptist is testifying here to the Godhead and the eternality of Jesus, just in the same way that John the Apostle was. John the Apostle just calls on John the Baptist to confirm his own testimony and to confirm what he's writing here. Then our author steps away from this parenthesis in verse 15, back in 16, and he continues on his point that he began in verse 15. He says, "For from His fullness we have all received grace upon grace." He states from His fullness, we have all received grace and truth. The all here, in the immediate context, would certainly be John and those who walked with Jesus, and also the readers of this book or this letter when it was first written. But this extends beyond them. It extends beyond just those immediate readers and just the immediate believers in Jesus. We find in chapter 17 of this book that really John is pointing to something Jesus says later on in His ministry. He gives us a glimpse of Jesus' prayer the night before He's crucified. Again, in chapter 17 of John, Jesus begins by praying for Himself. Then He prays for the apostles and the disciples that were alive at that time and who walked with Him and followed Him. And then in verse 20, He ends by saying this. He says, "I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in Me through their word." Speaking of the apostles or the disciples' word. Jesus in that prayer, everything He prayed for the disciples, for the apostles that were with Him at that time, He then included all future believers who would believe through their word and through the generations who would preach their word and speak their word through the revelation of God's word. He prayed for them in the same way. He said, "All these I include as well." He's praying to the Father. We all then have received grace upon grace. We're included in this. John states again that we've received grace upon grace, and this is really another phrase which is hard to translate into the English. I know we've had several of these as we've gone through these 18 verses, and I'm sorry about that, but it is what it is. We don't have a direct translation. You know, it's hard to sometimes go from one language to another, and so we do our best to try to explain what is trying to be said here. There are two options really which represent the best translation, what John is saying here. Both, honestly, are true, and they're really worthy of considering and covering. So let's try to dig into them. The first translation is similar to what we get in the ESV here. It is the idea that we have an unending amount of grace bestowed upon us. It is unending because it is coming from the very source, full of grace. A source that is an unlimited supply of grace, since He is the Eternal One and the Creator, right? I really liked, again, how Bruce pictured this grace upon grace, if this is, in fact, the best way to look at this. He likened it to an ocean. Grace, the grace of Jesus being like an ocean, or the source being Jesus, and again, like an ocean. And when you look at the shore of an ocean, you see water and you can't see the end of it. It's just, it goes on and on and on. And not only that, you look closer to the shore and you see waves just continue to roll in, one after another. We went to the beach a couple of weeks ago, and Mike and I got out into the ocean because she likes to play out in the waves. And we were out there, and wave after wave just continued to hit us, continued to come over us. There was really no break at times, and no end, and there was certainly no end in sight as you looked out there, and we saw those waves coming in. I mean, they kept on coming. They weren't stopping. That's kind of the picture we get here. That's the picture of grace upon grace. We have one wave of grace hit us, and as soon as we think it's finished, as that grace begins to end, or we feel like it's about to end, we have another fresh wave of grace just crash into us, and it continues to just be the same thing over and over. As children of God, we just have a brand new wave of grace that never ends and continues to fill us. And that's a beautiful picture, isn't it? And that's true. It is very true. But there's a second translation that is also possible here. D.A. Carson articulates it the best. Again, I won't get into a Greek lesson here, but basically, he believes that the best translation is, we have all received grace instead of grace. So, not grace upon grace, but grace instead of grace. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when you read it in the English, right? I don't know how that would make sense in English. But he explains that this makes sense when you take it in context of verse 17. In verse 17 we read, "For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." So in verse 17 we read that, and we see a contrast between the law that was given to Moses and the grace that came through Jesus. John, in this whole book, he contrasts the law and Jesus. He does that quite often. Now, we know that generally the law is seen as salvation through works, right? We know that. It's a taskmaster. There is no give in it. It's either you carry the whole law, you abide by the whole law, but if you break one, you're doomed. There is no, you've broken the whole thing. And man cannot keep the law. Man will always be condemned through the law. There is no way to be saved through it. That's why Jesus came. And we are now saved by faith. By grace through faith, right? So salvation through Jesus is rightly seen as salvation through grace. And that's exactly what John is saying here, and he's contrasting it to the law. But, as Carson points out, the law was not without grace as well. There was grace imparted by God in the law. The fact that God gave the law in the first place was an act of grace, especially to the Israelites. It gave them a perfect way to govern their nation. It also leads humanity as a whole to realize that they cannot save themselves. There's grace in that, right? Now, the law is certainly not a law of grace. It's never going to be known as a law of grace. And so there is certainly a clear distinction between the law and Jesus, specifically in how we are saved. But there is an element of grace in the law. So it is possible that John is just drawing a distinction in the grace that we now have in Jesus compared to the grace that was available in the law. There was grace in the law, but now this is the grace that we have instead of that grace. We have grace from the fullness of the eternal Word, and not just in the shadows of Him contained in the law. We have the fullness now. And in verse 17, John is drawing another major distinction between the law and the Word. And it is here that for the first time, John makes this clear statement that Jesus Christ is the eternal Word who became flesh. Notice how he writes this, though. He says, "For the law was given through Moses." We know the story of Moses at Mount Sinai when he received the law. God spoke to him in a cloud over the mountains for 40 days and 40 nights. Moses then gave the law to the people of Israel. The law was then was given to him, though, right? It did not come from him. He did not create the law. It did not originate in him. It was God's law, which he gave to Moses, who then gave to Israel. But as we see here, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Grace and truth were not given to Jesus. He is the source of grace and truth. As the authority, he also has the authority as to who receives grace and truth. As the originator of grace and truth, Jesus didn't need to rely on anyone else to determine what type of grace was going to be given, nor depend on anyone else to determine the amount of grace to be given. He can distribute it as fully as He pleases, and He does. As Carson states, in Judaism, the law became an end to it in itself, something that could be separated from Moses, through whom it was given. The grace and truth which came by Jesus Christ can never be disassociated from Him. That's true. We can never take the grace and truth away from Christ. It can never be pulled away from Him. Jesus is grace and truth. And it is through Jesus, who is grace and truth, that we have grace and truth. John then goes into verse 18 and he states, "No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made Him known." John wraps up this section in this prologue in verse 18 by stating again, no one has ever seen God. Let's unpack this whole verse, but let's begin by that statement first. No one has ever seen God. So you mean to tell me that in the Old Testament, when Abraham spoke to God before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that he didn't see God? Or when Moses is said to have spoken to God face to face as a friend speaks to a friend, he didn't see God? Or what about Isaiah when he saw God seated on a throne high and lifted up, that he didn't see God? Well, the text says he didn't, right? He says no man has seen God. It's very clear. What is John saying here? Well, first, God is spirit, John makes that clear in chapter 4. Spirit cannot be seen. In all of the Old Testament passages where God is seen, it was either a version of His glory, as we see in the Shekinah glory, that cloud, or the glory that the hinder parts that came by Moses as he was in the cleft of the rock, or it was pre-incarnate Jesus who appeared in the form of a human that was a temporary form. That form was not born, though, right? Never in the Old Testament when we see Jesus as pre-incarnate, Jesus speaking specifically, again, you can look to Abraham as he speaks to Jesus before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. That body was not born. It didn't begin in a manger. It didn't begin anywhere other than God just, He formed that to speak to Moses. That form was not subject to normal limits and weaknesses of the human body, but the only God who is at the Father's side, as we read here, He has made God known. So what does that mean? How can God not be seen and be the only God and also be by the Father's side, who is also God, and make Him known? Let's see if we can try and understand that a little better. I think the NIV has probably the best translation of this verse, so I'll read that to you. It says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is Himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made Him known." I also like the NET. The NET version reads this, says, "No one has ever seen God. The only one, Himself God, who is in closest fellowship with the Father, has made God known." Both of those are very good. They're not direct, they're not literal translations, but they do the best job of saying what John is saying here, trying to say here in the Greek. The Greek term used for "has made Him known" is the term we get the word for exegesis from. Some of you may know that word, may have heard us use that word up here. It's a common word used in preaching, and what I hope we do here, it means to explain or to interpret something. Specifically in preaching, it is to take a passage, to take a text, to explain or interpret that text as we're preaching. It can also mean that exegesis can also mean to narrate or to tell a narrative. So we could say that Jesus is the narrative of God. Jesus is the exegesis of God. He's the explanation of who God is to humanity. As C.H. Dodd states, Jesus gives life and is life. He raises the dead and is the resurrection. He gives bread and is bread. He speaks truth and is the truth. So as He speaks the Word, He is the Word. The point is this. The Word is God eternal. The Word became flesh and was the man Jesus. Jesus, then, is God eternal. He is also the Son of God. As the Son of God, Jesus has a unique and close relationship with the Father, unlike anyone else. The Greek literally reads, "The Son is in the bosom of the Father" here. We are all sons of God, but Jesus is the one and unique Son of God. How can Jesus be the Son of God and also God, though? Well, when I figure out the Trinity, I'll let you know. If you figure it out, let me know. But despite the fact that it's hard to wrap our mind around how Jesus can be the Son and also be God, as well as God be the Father and also be God, and they be one, and then we have the Holy Spirit who makes up the Trinity, and we serve a God in three persons, one God in three persons, despite the fact that we can't wrap our minds around that, it's still true. That's the God we serve. And praise God that we serve a God we can't understand fully. Because if we did, as John MacArthur, I don't want to take it from him, but he says, if we served a God who we could completely understand, we'd serve a little God. The fact we can't understand everything that He is and everything that that He has going on is true, or is fact that shows proof that we serve a big God. When humanity saw Jesus, though, they saw God. In chapter 14, Jesus, when He's talking to the disciples, He said this in verse 7. He says, "If you had known Me, you would have known My Father also. From now on, you do know Him and have seen Him." This confused Philip. So in verse 8, Philip goes on and he asks, he says, "Lord," he says, "show us the Father, and it is enough for us." Philip didn't understand how he had seen the Father, right? Jesus said, you have seen the Father. And Philip said, I don't understand how I've seen it. Just show us the Father. And it's enough. So in verse 9, Jesus says this. He says, have I been with you so long and you still don't know me, Philip? Whoa. What? Philip asked to see the Father, and Jesus says, you mean you don't know me even though I've been with you this long? He's asking to see the Father, and Jesus says, you don't know me? I've been with you the entire time. So is Jesus the Father? Not exactly. Jesus goes on to explain. He says, how can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on the account of the works themselves. Jesus is telling Philip that he and the Father are one. They're inseparable. When they heard Jesus talk, they heard the Father talk. When they saw Jesus perform signs and wonders, they saw the Father performing signs and wonders. There was never a time that Jesus did anything apart from the will of the Father. Their wills aligned perfectly because they are one. In chapter 16, Jesus is still talking. He's been talking for a while to them. In verse 1, he says to the disciples, he says, I have said all these things to you to keep you from falling away. They will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering service to God. Then in verse 3, Jesus says this, and they will do these things because they have not known the Father nor me. So in order to know the Father, you have to know Jesus. If you know Jesus, then you know the Father. The Son and the Father are one, and Jesus has made God known to us. In the Old Testament, when someone saw God, they saw Jesus. The pre-incarnate, that's why pre-incarnate, I say that Abraham saw the pre-incarnate Jesus. There's no doubt that that was God speaking to Abraham. That was the pre-incarnate Jesus. But also, when the Word became flesh, God revealed Himself to a man in a way, or to man in a way that he'd never done it before. In Jesus, we see the ultimate revelation of God Himself. Hebrews 1 begins like this. It says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. So long ago, God spoke as the Word to the prophets. But, the writer of Hebrews goes on and says, but in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son. He is the radiance, the Son is the radiance of the glory of God, and He's the exact imprint of His nature. Jesus is God. When they saw Jesus, they saw God. Tenney sums up this verse this way. I like to tell you something. He said, the nature of the invisible and mysterious God is thus interpreted by one who is qualified to do so through kinship and understanding. Meaning, Jesus alone is qualified to explain the nature of the invisible and mysterious God, because He alone is the unique Son of God, and He alone is God. Who can give a better and fuller description of who you are than you, right? I mean, everybody can see things about you. They can see you. They know things about you, but only you know your thoughts. Only you know what's going on inside. No one could explain you better than you, and only Jesus could explain God in the way that He did. So John is really bringing this whole prologue home for us here. This has been what he's been leading up to. And if you notice, you can notice the parallels between verse 1 and verse 18. In the bosom of the Father, as I noted earlier, has a parallel with God. The unique one, Himself God, is a parallel to was God, back in verse 1. And the Word is God's self-expression, or it is Him making Himself known. So John has made clear that the Word known to the prophets and revealed to Israel as God is eternal, and that Word became flesh as the man Jesus, and He made God known to us in the ultimate revelation through His words and His actions. Jesus' life was the ultimate revelation of God to man. And John will spend the rest of this book proving that and explaining to us how God has made Himself known to us through the person of Jesus. What a great God we serve is all I can say. We should rejoice that God has expressed and explained Himself in such a definitive and impactful way through the person of Jesus. We should rejoice that His glory is full of goodness and mercy, and even more, that that glory then is given to us freely if we believe in Jesus, who Himself is God, full of grace and truth. Honestly, it's exciting to think about going through this book knowing that. It's exciting to know that we're going to spend the rest of this book learning how that glory, how that goodness was displayed while Jesus was on earth. How God revealed Himself to us. And how God wants us to know Him. He's given us His Word to know Him. He gave us His life to know Him. He gave us everything we need to know about Him, about His glory, and about His goodness, His mercy, and His truth. And I hope as we continue to go through this book that we really love Him more because of that. We get a better understanding of Him because of that. And we have all the more reason to praise Him for that. Everyone stand.